Hello and welcome to another Intensive Care at Home and IntensiveCareHotline.com live stream. Ask me anything, life support decisions, ICU decisions, tracheostomy decisions, mechanical ventilation, anything related to intensive care and intensive care at home. You can ask me anything. My name is Patrick Hutzel and I am the host, your host of this show. I have been doing these live streams for a long time, and I also want to welcome our viewers that watch this on replay, as I know that not everyone can make it live, but if you are here live, this is your opportunity to ask me anything in relation to my area of expertise, which is, again, intensive care and intensive care at home. You can ask me anything about life support decisions, ICU decisions in general, when it comes to decisions about tracheostomy, and of course, intensive care at home. My name is Patrick Hutzel. I'm the host of your show. We'll be going for approximately an hour here where you have the opportunity to ask me anything. You can type your questions into the chat pad or you can connect with me live on the StreamYard link here that I posted in the chat pad. Now, what makes me qualified to host a show where you can ask me anything about intensive care at home, where you can ask me about life support decisions in ICU, ICU decisions in general, tracheostomy, intensive care at home. I'm a critical care nurse by background, having worked in ICU and critical care nursing for over 25 years in three different countries, where I worked as a nurse unit manager for over 5 years in intensive care, and where I've been consulting and advocating for families in intensive care at IntensiveCareHotline.com since 2013. I'm also the founder of IntensiveCareHotline.com. I'm also the founder and managing director of Intensive Care at Home, and you can find more information at IntensiveCareAtHome.com. With Intensive Care at Home, we're sending our critical care nurses into the home 24 hours a day, as a genuine alternative to a long-term stay in intensive care, predominantly for long-term ventilated adults and children with tracheostomies, but also for adults and children on BiPAP, CPAP ventilation without tracheostomy, tracheostomy without mechanical ventilation, home TPN, home IV potassium, home IV magnesium, home IV antibiotic infusions, PEEK line, central line, Hickman's line, as well as port management at home, nasogastric tube management at home, PEEK tube management at home, pitch tube management at home, nasojejunostomy tube at home. We're also managing cough assist machines at home. We're providing ventilation weaning as well as palliative care at home. And we are also providing level 2 and level 3 NDIS support coordination with intensive care at home. We're also providing TAC and WorkSafe case management for intensive care at home. So, without further ado, let's go into today's questions that have come in during the week, and I just want to cover any topics, you know, that need to be covered. Also, if you like the content that I'm doing here, like the video, subscribe to my YouTube channel, comment below what you want to see next, what questions and insights you have, share the video with anyone that can benefit from the information that I am providing here. and share the message far and wide. Now, I want to start with another unfortunate incident that came about in the last week or so, where the NDIS funding decisions have cost another life. And last week I spoke about Koa, the little girl that was also a victim of poor NDIS funding decisions. And that happened in Geelong in Victoria. I've made a video about that last week in this live stream where I talked about it. Now, there has been another NDIS participant death, unfortunately. And what happened here is that we were looking after a client earlier in the year with 24-hour nursing care, a client with myasthenia gravis, client on BiPAP, or client who was BiPAP dependent because of the myasthenia gravis, chronic pain, lots of opiates, lots of morphine, oxycodone that the client needed to stay pain-free, but also a lot of other health issues secondary to her disability, which would have been atrial fibrillation. She had pulmonary emboli in the past. She had diabetes. She had a gastric reflux. She had sleep apnea. You know, she had quite a complex medical history and she needed 24-hour nursing care. That was actually confirmed by an independent nursing assessment. And whilst we were able to provide 24-hour nursing care there earlier in the year, the NDIS completely ignored the independent nursing assessment. It's not our nursing assessment. It's coming from an independent assessor. And then removed the funding for nursing care. The day they removed the funding for nursing care, I highlighted the situation as an incident with the NDIS Quality and Safety Commission, saying that the client would be at risk of dying, that if 24/7 nursing care is not going to be reinstated. The incident on the Quality and Safety Commission website got closed 2 weeks later without any action being taken from the NDIS Quality and Safety Commission against the NDIS, or being without any action taken from the NDIS, even though they had access to the independent NDIS nursing assessment that clearly demanded 24-hour nursing care with critical care nurses for this patient, for this client, I should say. The incident got closed without any accountability, without any further action taken. We know from the client that, you know, from the client's husband that she spent most of her remaining days in ICU, and you already can see where this is going when I say, you know, she spent her remaining days in ICU. She passed away on the 15th of September, and just as we predicted, right? And she passed away in ICU instead of having quality of life at home, or, you know, in her situation as well, maybe quality of end of life. But irregardless, she certainly didn't want to stay in a hospital, didn't want to die in a hospital. And, you know, the NDIS, once again, is making very poor decisions. Now, I will say this, the NDIS has come a long way, right? And, you know, given where the NDIS started to fund nursing care in late 2019, it certainly has come a long way. I will admit that. And it certainly has improved the lives for many clients and their families. It still has a long way to go, though. And it has a long way to go, especially around accountability or the lack thereof, because there is no accountability. You know, patients have died, and I've highlighted this on this blog, because of poor decision making from NDIS bureaucrats who don't understand the clinical side of the NDIS. And that poor decision making has clearly led to, unfortunately, patients and clients passing away unnecessarily, and it would have been preventable. Okay, let's then move on to other questions that have come in during the week. One question that has come in is from Dominique, who says, "Hi, Patrick. My husband is in ICU and it's almost like they're testing to see how close he is to death with their hidden agenda. About a week ago, they told me his brain is very good and as he woke up within 2 minutes and he did a few commands and they sedated him again, which I was happy about because I was told that they were going to keep him awake. One time they went to wake him up and he reached straight away for the breathing tube. What do they do instead of exploring all different alternatives to help him and to relax him? They sedate him and sedation is getting overused. I felt they were testing to see if their drugs have affected him yet, and if not, instead of waking him up and progress well, they hindered his progress to fit their narrative. That is very sick because obviously I know from that operation he's not as sick as they are portraying him to be. I see another agenda happening in front of me, and they're denying and avoiding my questions. All of the questions are about my husband's health and well-being. I want to understand better to be the best for him. Am I doing the right thing?" From Dominique. Well, Dominique, I can tell you, you are doing exactly the right thing. You are doing exactly the right thing by questioning. And what you need to do as a matter of urgency, and it's for all families, you need to get access to the medical records. I can't believe that families in intensive care continue to fly blind when their loved ones are in intensive care. You need to access the medical records as quickly as possible. What we are finding, because we are reviewing medical records all the time, we are finding that what intensive care teams are telling families is actually very different to what's being discussed in the medical records or what's being documented in the medical records. Right? So it's a tricky one, but you need to have access to the medical records and you need to make your power moves here, by questioning. If you don't think you can make power moves, you have already lost. You can make power moves. One of those power moves is to get access to the medical records and get consulting and advocacy and get a second opinion. Right? So, and it is common that some ICUs overuse sedation and that you need to advocate. They overuse sedation and also opiates. Right, and keep patients asleep in a coma for much longer than necessary. And here is why you need to counteract that as quickly as possible. Every day, your family member is in an induced coma for longer than necessary. They're rapidly deconditioning, rapidly losing muscles. And it is going to be much more difficult to wean them off the ventilator and the breathing tube if they're kept in an induced coma for longer than actually necessary. Right? And unfortunately, what you are describing is very common in intensive care. And you're absolutely right to be asking these questions. ICU teams often overuse sedation because it makes patient management easier for them, but it doesn't always serve the patient's best interest. Sedation can delay waking up, delay ventilator weaning, and can even create the illusion that your loved one is sicker than they actually are. From what you're sharing, your husband has already shown signs of neurological responsiveness strength, which is very positive. When a patient tries to pull out their breathing tube, the first reflex of ICU staff is often to sedate and use opiates instead of addressing discomfort, anxiety, or communication needs. Alternatives such as pain relief, reassurance, repositioning, physical comfort, or even discussing early tracheostomy in some cases to make things easier are often ignored in favor of sedation and opiates. Unfortunately, this keeps families in the dark and feeds into the agenda of controlling the often negative narrative and the bed management process in intensive care. So it is, you know, if you don't question here, you know, with all of your might, you are fighting an uphill battle, you know, and instead of using pain relief and sedatives, it could be as simple as, you know, does your husband need his back washed? Does he need to be turned from his left right to his right side? Right? You may be surprised what you find just by doing what's common sense and what can be done with good nursing care. Right? Does he need a bed bath? Does he need mouth care? Does he just need someone to hold his hand? Right? Before using sedatives and opiates and God knows what. So you're absolutely doing the right thing. By asking questions, observing carefully, and refusing to accept vague answers, you are advocating for your husband. ICU teams often have competing interests, such as freeing up ICU beds because they're in such high demand, financial management, or simply making things easier for staff. That's why families who ask the right questions and seek second opinions are the ones who can influence better outcomes. So here's my advice. Get access to the medical records. That is number one. Keep questioning sedation and opiate use and ask for sedation breaks, spontaneous awakening trials. Ask why sedation is necessary instead of exploring alternatives. Ask for ventilation settings. Right? Your husband might be much closer to have the breathing tube removed than you might think. And ask and insist on regular neurological assessments when sedation and opiates are off. If your husband can follow commands and show responsiveness, that's very, very encouraging. Push for early extubation. Can he be extubated onto BiPAP, CPAP? Can he be extubated onto high-flow nasal prongs? Can he be mobilized as quickly as possible? And if all of that is not an option, legitimately not an option, does he need a tracheostomy? Always remember, in intensive care, you don't question, you don't get the answer. And the reality is ICU teams will not volunteer information unless you ask specifically. You're doing the right thing, Dominique. Keep going. But you also need to get access to the medical records. You also need either myself or another advocate to talk to them directly. But you need to have an advocate who understands intensive care inside out. Otherwise, you, again, are fighting an uphill battle. You know, don't let the intensive care team give you smoke and mirrors. Right? Because that's what it often is. It's smoke and mirrors. But you also need to know what you're looking for and what you need to advocate for. Right? If you're not doing that, you are fighting an uphill battle. Okay, let's move on to the next question. But before I do that, if you have any questions, type them into the chat pad or simply connect with me live here on the StreamYard link. If there are no questions, I have the next question here from one of our members who says, "Hi, Patrick. I was wondering if you have any information about using a pacemure speaking valve with patients who have a tracheostomy. It sounds like a pacemure speaking valve would be beneficial with my dad's speech therapy and being able to talk. I do feel like my dad has been trying to speak to us as well and can't because of his current situation and because of his tracheostomy. I will also find out as soon as I speak to my mom tonight if he has had any speech therapy at this point. Thank you for all you do and God bless from Bridget." So, thank you, Bridget, for sharing this question. And it's a great and very important question that many families in intensive care to ask. You know, I can't stress enough how important it is that you do ask the right questions, but I also can't stress enough how important it is for you to get access to the medical records, or if there's a delay, that you and I talk to the doctors and nurses directly so that I can ask a series of questions. So, coming back to your question, Bridget, when someone has a tracheostomy in intensive care, one of the biggest challenges is communication. Families often feel distressed because their loved one is alert, trying to speak, but simply cannot be heard. That's where the passimmure valve, also known as the speaking valve, comes into play. Now, some patients in ICU can actually write on a piece of paper or even on a PC or on an iPad, but that doesn't seem to be the case with your dad's situation. Right? But here's what you need to know. The passimmure valve is a one-way speaking valve. It allows your dad to breathe in through the tracheostomy, but forces the exhaled air to go past the vocal cords and out through the mouth and nose. This makes speech possible again. Next, it actually helps with speech therapy. Speech therapists in ICU and rehab settings often use the passimmure valve not only to help with communication, but also to assess swallowing, secretion management, and the possibility of progressing towards decannulation, which is the removal of the tracheostomy. But not every patient is ready immediately. To use the valve safely, your dad needs to be alert enough to manage secretions. Have the tracheostomy cuff deflated. Have stable breathing and oxygen levels. And needs to be assessed by a speech pathologist or a critical care nurse familiar with tracheostomy and passimmure valve use. But it's more than just talking, because the passimmure valve can also improve swallowing, reduce aspiration risk, help re-establish a normal breathing pattern, and improve quality of life dramatically, because your dad will finally be able to communicate directly his needs. So in summary, yes, the passimmure valve can absolutely help your dad speak after a tracheostomy, but it needs to be assessed and managed by the ICU team speech therapy or tracheostomy trained nurses, which are really only critical care nurses. I've seen many patients light up with relief the first time they can say hello to their families again after weeks or months of silence. If your dad hasn't had a speech therapy review yet, I strongly recommend you push for it as soon as possible. Don't wait. This can make all the difference for his recovery and quality of life. So, that covers that. Now, if you have any questions, type them in the chat pad or connect with me live on the StreamYard link. The link is in the chat pad. If there are no questions, I will carry on with the next question that's come in from a reader and client. And the reader says, "Hi, Patrick. It is my concern that they have pumped him full of so many fluids and have not given him the medical care he needed in the beginning to survive this. I feel like they have taken away the chance he had to survive this, because from the beginning they recommended pulling him from life support, stating he had no chance, zero chance of recovering from the anoxic brain injury. I've only asked for time to see if he could wake up. They do not want him in the ICU. They have not made me feel his life is not worth fighting for from the beginning. And yes, I know that they have done a lot here medically, but my fear has been that underlying decisions have been made to speed up the process of his decline. One of those things being pumping him so full of so many fluids, not replacing a bad port on his right side that was clotting, then switching to a 3-hour dialysis that was not good for him, waiting too long and allowing him to fill up with too many fluids after 2 cardiac arrests. They finally outpoured in the left side that has worked just fine. They refuse TPN for him, They refuse TPN for him. I've had comments from the nurses right after he came out of sedation saying he would have done waking up already, which I feel he was trying to do at that time. Other nurses have said that they don't like people in this condition hanging out here. That's terrible when nurses say something like that in ICU. Hanging out here, who hangs out in an ICU? That's just ridiculous. Nobody's hanging out in an ICU. Patients go there because they need life support. They need medical treatment, urgent medical treatment. Families hang out there because they want to see their loved ones in a critical condition. No one's hanging out there. Anyway, the doctor stated we were not being pressured to remove life support and that it is not true, but we are. They have told us that we should remove life support and give medications to keep him comfortable. They leave us for a few minutes and come back for our decision. What should I do? From Bonnie. Okay, so Bonnie, here's my take. What you're describing is unfortunately very common in intensive care. Families are often told very early on after an anoxic brain injury that there's quote-unquote zero chance of recovery. But the reality is nobody knows for sure what your loved one's trajectory will look like in the days, weeks, and months after cardiac arrest. The intensive care team is looking at bed management, financial pressures, staffing, and other resources. Patients with brain injuries are often labeled as not viable early on, and then families are pressured into withdrawing life support under the guise of quote-unquote comfort care. And you're absolutely right to be concerned about fluid overload, which can worsen heart, lung, and kidney function. You should be concerned about dialysis mismanagement. Switching to short 3-hour dialysis instead of continuous dialysis is much more taxing on the body, is much more taxing on the blood pressure, and can be much more taxing on the kidneys themselves. Delays in inserting a proper port, which is causing unnecessary setbacks. Refusal to start TPN. TPN stands for total parenteral nutrition. It's also known as IV or intravenous nutrition. Because it is critical, TPN is critical if a patient cannot be fed via the gut. These are clinical decisions that directly impact your loved one's chances of recovery. And when nurses and doctors made comments such as, oh, he would have woken up already, or we don't like people in this condition hanging out here, it shows a bias that is not in your loved one's best interest. It absolutely isn't. So what should you be doing here? Well, first of all, do not give in to any pressures. Right? That is so important that you do not give in to any of the real or perceived pressures. Right? There's no need for that. You can make up your own mind, which you already have, right? You can and you should be making up your own mind of what to do next here. And you're doing great by saying, well, you know, I'm questioning everything they are doing here, and rightly so. I do apologize for this. I do apologize. I hope you can hear me now. In any case, we were talking about, you know, Bonnie challenging the intensive care team with her husband, and she's doing all the right things. But once again, I can't stress enough that any family in intensive care needs access to the medical records as quickly as possible, right? And clearly, the ICU team is biased here for their own agenda and for their own agenda only in terms of what they're trying to achieve. You know, no one has spoken about BiPAP, CPAP, or extubating onto BiPAP or CPAP. No one has spoken about, you know, stopping sedation. No one has spoken about maybe extubating onto high-flow nasal prongs. Nobody has spoken about doing physical therapy, right? And helping this man to get off sedation, get off opiates, and moving towards extubation as quickly as possible. And do not give in to the pressures, because ICU is often trying to fast-track a withdrawal of life support narrative. And you are absolutely right to ask for more time. Next, you need to insist on continued treatment. Demand appropriate dialysis, fluid management, TPN or nutrition, and the best possible medical care. Right? It's very simple. But also keep in mind that the biggest challenge for families in intensive care is that they don't know what they don't know. They don't know what to look for. They don't know what questions to ask. They don't know their rights, and they don't know how to manage doctors and nurses in intensive care. And that is really what 99.9% of families in intensive care struggle with. They don't even know that managing an intensive care team is possible if you have the right advice. But you need to do it from day one, and not just when things are happening and when you can't catch up or when you can't keep up with what's actually really happening. Also, challenge the prognosis. Nobody, and I mean nobody, can exactly predict neurological recovery at this early stage. Recovery from an anoxic brain injury can take sometimes weeks or months. Next, document everything, and I mean everything. Every comment from nurses and doctors that pressures you to withdraw life support, write it down. It creates accountability. Also, I know I sound like a broken record, but that's also why you need access to the medical records, so you can actually see that what's documented in the medical records is what's actually happening out there in the real world, and that what's documenting is actually what they're doing with your husband and vice versa. And also, of course, get professional advocacy. You need to get advocacy from myself and from intensivecarehotline.com. We have changed seemingly impossible situations around, right? We've turned them around. We've saved many lives for our clients in intensive care over the years, and that is all documented on our intensivecarehotline.com testimonial section, and it's documented on our intensivecarehotline.com podcast section, where we've done client interviews. And you're absolutely right, Bonnie. The bottom line is the ICU team is inappropriately pressuring you to stop life support when your loved one probably still has a chance. Keep in mind that 70 to 90% of intensive care patients actually survive. So that means the odds are in your husband's favor, right? Unfortunately, the intensive care system is set up to save resources, not necessarily to save lives when things get difficult and a prolonged recovery is needed to help your husband survive. And what you should do is clearly you need to hold your ground, get the right advice, and don't make rushed decisions. Time is your ally in intensive care, actually. Time is not your enemy. So I hope that helps. If you have any questions, please type them into the chat pad or connect with me live here on the StreamYard link. If you don't have any questions, I will carry on with the next question that came in during the week from Tony. Tony says, "Hi, Patrick. My husband is in ICU, and they are telling me the only thing left to do is to let him die. Is this true? That nothing else can be done. They still refuse any TPN for him. My husband's had a cardiac arrest 7 days ago. He's got an anoxic brain injury. He's not waking up, even though sedation and opiates have been stopped. And he has a bowel obstruction. Please help from Tony. So, it's a situation I see all the time in intensive care, Tony. Families are being told there's nothing else we can do, and that the only thing left to do is to let your loved one die. Let me be very clear. When ICU teams are telling you this, it often has little to do with what is actually possible for your loved one's treatment and recovery, and has much more to do with bed management strategies. They want to free up ICU beds. Financial management, intensive care is very expensive, and they're operating on tight budgets. Staff and resource management, they don't want to allocate resources to long-term patients. The worst case scenario from an intensive care perspective is that a patient stays indefinitely with an uncertain prognosis and outcome. And that's exactly what your husband's situation is. It's uncertain and it's prolonged, and they don't want that. They also want to stay in control of the narrative who lives and who dies in ICU. They want to make that decision, right? And that's very inappropriate, right? Their job should be to save lives. Next, there is a narrative of futility of treatment, which is often premature and designed to see you towards withdrawal of treatment inappropriately and prematurely. Once again, I can only repeat that 70 to 90% of intensive care patients survive. So the odds are in your family member's favor. So to sell you on a withdrawal of treatment is inappropriate, and the conversation should shift towards, okay, what is it that we can control here? You know, especially when the odds are in the patient's favor. Obviously, your husband had a cardiac arrest with an anoxic brain injury, and it's very serious, but the idea that nothing else can be done after only 7 days is simply not true. Recovery from an anoxic brain injury can take weeks and months, not days. I have worked with many families in intensive care where patients have been given no hope by ICU teams at day 7, 10, or even 14, and yet months later, those patients made significant recoveries. I've even got podcasts where I've interviewed clients that have been in situations like that, right? The fact that your husband has a bowel obstruction and is being denied TPN, TPN stands for total parenteral nutrition, also known as IV nutrition, intravenous nutrition, is deeply concerning because they're basically denying your husband nutrition. Now, getting nutrition is a basic human right, and it's vital in ICU. Studies have shown that if patients are not being adequately given nutrition, they have poor outcomes. And nutrition is vital in ICU, especially after cardiac arrest and brain injury. If your husband cannot have enteral feeding due to the bowel obstruction, TPN is absolutely essential and the standard of care, and needs to be initiated as a matter of urgency to avoid malnutrition, muscle wasting, infections, and further complications. Here's what you need to do immediately. Number one, once again, you need to get access to the medical records. How come you haven't got access to the medical records? How come if an ICU team is trying to quote unquote sell you an end of life that you are not getting access to the medical records? That's unbelievable. You can't afford that, not to have access to the medical records and check what's in there. Next, you need to push for TPN right now. This is a basic requirement if bowel obstruction prevents normal feeding. Get clarity on sedation and opiates. If they've been stopped, it can still take days or longer for a patient to wake up. Ask if the kidneys and the liver is working, right? Because if the kidney and the liver is not working, then that might also delay your husband waking up, right? Ask for a clear neurological assessment and prognosis timelines. Not just he won't wake up. Have they done an EEG? Have they done a CT scan of the brain? Have they done an MRI scan of the brain? Right? Has a neurologist even seen him? Next, do not let them rush you into withdrawal of life support. It's your decision, not theirs. Ask if this is a real or a perceived end-of-life situation. Well, what's the difference? I'm glad you've asked. A real end-of-life situation is a situation where a real end-of-life situation in intensive care is a situation where nothing will save your husband's life. Nothing. No surgery, no treatment, no equipment, no medication. No, nothing will save your husband's life. That's a real end-of-life situation. An end-of-life is imminent. Your husband's going to die within hours. That is a real end-of-life situation. Everything else is a perceived end-of-life situation. What that means is there's a perception that your loved one might die. Well, we're all going to die, right? But the question is when and how, right? So, it's a perceived end-of-life situation. They perceive that your husband will die and that it's, quote unquote, in his best interest to die, which I've yet to find out how it could be in someone's best interest to die unless they want to die. Right? You also have to ask, where's the rush to kill someone? Where's the urgency to kill someone? Right? Ask that question. It's highly relevant. And of course, once again, once you know, get access to the medical records and get specialist advocacy, which is what we provide here at intensivecarehotline.com, to keep your husband's treatment going and make sure he gets every chance to recovery and making sure he gets best care and treatment always. And Tony, it's simply not true that nothing else can be done. Unless it's a real end-of-life situation, a lot can be done. What is true is that ICU is trying to push their agenda and narrative of end-of-life care because it suits them often. Not your husband and not you. Your husband needs time, proper nutrition, treatment for his bowel obstruction, and ongoing critical care to save his life. Don't let them pressure you into making a premature life or death decision after only 7 days. Right? Also, we have saved so many lives for our clients in intensive care over the years. You don't know what you don't know. And no one can force you to agree to kill your husband. No one. Right? So do not let them pressure you. Shift the conversation from them wanting to withdraw life support, shift the conversation to what can be done to help your husband survive. What can be done to give your husband the best care and treatment? Change the narrative. You can change the narrative, but you need to be proactive about it. Okay, so let's move on to the next question. Let's get on to the next question. And let's get on to the next question. So the next question is, it's quite a general question that we get. How long do you need mechanical ventilation after a lung transplant? That's a question we get all the time. So the reality is it really depends on the situation. In a straightforward lung transplant where surgery goes well, the donor lungs are a good match and there are no immediate complications. Your loved one may only need a ventilator for 24 to 72 hours. Sometimes they can be extubated within a couple of days or even less. I've certainly seen all of that when I worked in ICU. I've looked after plenty of patients in ICU with lung transplant, heart transplant as well. So I've seen those straightforward cases. Now let's look at another scenario. And you know, patients can be out of ICU within 24, 48 hours. One of the biggest issues is often pain control. You know, having a lung transplant can be extremely painful, right? And one of the biggest challenges there is around pain management. But that can often be managed with an epidural. And you know, patients again should be mobilized as quickly as possible so they can start rehabilitating as quickly as possible. I mean, that's the whole goal of getting a new set of donor lungs. So if the donor lungs are not perfect, which can be the case, you'll often may need ventilation for several days to a few weeks until the lungs start functioning optimally. Next, if there are complications such as primary graft dysfunction, bleeding, pneumonia, or rejection, then your loved one may need to stay on the ventilator for sometimes many weeks, and that could lead then to a tracheostomy as well. In some cases, patients require ECMO support, which is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which temporarily takes over the function of the lungs and sometimes the heart. If ECMO is needed, mechanical ventilation may be required for weeks or for longer. Once again, if the loved one can't be weaned off the ventilator within 1 to 2 weeks, a tracheostomy is often considered as the best option. That provides a safer and more stable airway compared to being intubated for too long. Now, here's what most families in intensive care don't know what options they really have. If your loved one ends up with a tracheostomy and ventilator dependency, ICUs often want to send them to long-term acute care, nursing homes, rehabilitation, LTAC in the US in particular. But that is not the best option. It's also not the best option that if your loved one ends up with a tracheostomy and ventilator dependency in ICU, there can also be the narrative of wanting to stop life support. Right? In any case, the much better option is to bring your loved one home with ICU level care 24/7 provided by ICU trained and critical care trained nurses, which is exactly what we do at intensivecareathome.com. So you can go to intensivecareathome.com for more information, because families get their loved one out of intensive care, avoid nursing homes, and have real peace of mind at home. So, in summary, after lung transplant, ventilator time can range from 24 to 72 hours in straightforward cases, several days to several weeks with imperfect donor lungs or complications, weeks or longer if ECMO is needed or complications arise, and if a tracheostomy is required, especially in the long term, intensive care at home is the solution to avoid ICU long term or avoid other environments. So, I hope that helps you understand what you may expect after a lung transplant. So, if you have any questions, please type them into the chat pad or connect with me live here on the StreamYard link. If you don't have any questions, I have another question from Dominique, who says, "Hi, Patrick. Hi, Patrick. I feel they're weaning my husband too early before he's ready, and as he struggles to breathe when they reduce the ventilator. On the third day of testing my husband to breathe, I was there yesterday and he struggled even more. He didn't start breathing on his own. The nurse left the machine off for a while. I became highly anxious and worried. I said to the nurse to put the ventilator back on after 3 or 4 seconds, which was completely ignored, and they left it for about 10 seconds upwards before switching the ventilator back on, stressing my husband out. They should not have done that. Again, I perceive that as medical negligence. They have been over-sedating him during his stay, and I have been trying to get the sedation and opiates reduced out of health concerns and because I was doing my own research. Despite his x-ray coming back clear a few days ago, they took him down for another x-ray yesterday. It seems that they are using any excuse they can to sedate him to justify sedating him even more, when he didn't need to be sedated at all, making it look like they want side effects to harm his health. Please help. I'm worried they won't be able to extubate him and that he needs a tracheostomy instead. It's a really important question, Dominique, and many families in intensive care face this situation when their loved one is ventilated and sedated. First of all, weaning a patient off the ventilator should never be rushed. If your husband is struggling to breathe when the ventilator support is reduced, it's a clear sign that his lungs, respiratory muscles, or overall condition are not ready yet. Pushing too early can lead to setbacks, complications, and unnecessary stress for both the patient and the family. But also, like I said in my other questions earlier, you need to get access to the medical records first and foremost. For anyone watching this, you have a family member in intensive care, first step, you need to get access to the medical records so that you can actually, you know, do your research. It's much easier to get a second opinion, and you actually have to watch that what you're seeing in the medical records is matching on what they're doing. From what you are describing, it sounds like the ICU team is attempting spontaneous breathing trials, but the fact that he's not initiating breaths and becoming distressed is concerning. Proper weaning requires careful monitoring, not simply testing to see if the patient can breathe. This needs to be clinically assessed with parameters such as blood gases, oxygen levels, tidal volumes, and respiratory effort. Your concern about over-sedation is valid too. Sedation is often overused in ICU, sometimes as a way to manage staffing shortages or bed management, but prolonged sedation delays weaning, weakens muscles, increases the risk of delirium, psychosis, pneumonia, and long-term complications. Families like yours often need to push to have sedation minimized as much as possible so the patient can wake up and participate in their own recovery. If I haven't said it often enough, if you have a family member in intensive care, you need to get access to the medical records right now. So, as for your worry about the tracheostomy, Dominique, you are right to ask that question. If a patient cannot be safely weaned off the breathing tube or the endotracheal tube within about 7 to 14 days, a tracheostomy should be considered. A tracheostomy has many benefits compared to prolonged intubation, including, but not limited to, increased comfort, no or minimal sedation and opiate needs, a much easier weaning process, lower risk of ventilator-associated pneumonia, better chances for mobilization and rehabilitation. Unfortunately, many ICUs push families into extubation, attempts that are premature, or they delay the tracheostomy because of cost, staffing, bed management concerns, and other resource concerns. This is where you need to take control of the situation. My advice is, number one, who would have thought that? Get access to the medical records. Get access to the medical records right now. Ask the ICU team for a clear weaning protocol and clear weaning parameters and why they believe your husband is ready to breathe on his own. Get the current ventilator settings, right? Also very important. And compare them to yesterday's ventilator settings or the day before. And, you know, compare them to tomorrow's then. It's like piecing together a puzzle. Demand to see arterial blood gases and the results and ventilator settings before and after weaning attempts. Ask directly if your husband meets criteria for a tracheostomy and why they might be delaying it. Ensure sedation and opiates are only given if absolutely necessary. It should not be given as a routine. So what you're experiencing is unfortunately very common. ICU teams often present their agenda first, which is bed management, cost, resources, whether it's staff or equipment, and also their narrative. And them wanting to stay in control, who can live and die. It has to be best for your loved one, full stop. Only that is what matters. You must keep asking questions, get access to the medical records, get a second opinion, and not let them push you at all. You know, never let anyone push you. Never, ever. Do what's right for you and for your family and for your loved one. So, I'm going to wrap this up in a couple of minutes. This is your last chance to ask a question. If you need help, go to intensivecarehotline.com. Call us on one of the numbers on the top of our website or simply send us an email to support@intensivecarehotline.com with your questions. We also have a membership for families of critically ill patients in intensive care. And you can become a member if you go to intensivecaresupport.org or if you go to intensivecarehotline.com and you click on the membership link. You know, you can also read our testimonials at intensivecarehotline.com and you can watch and listen to our podcast at intensivecarehotline.com, where we've done client interviews. With Intensive Care at Home, we are currently operating all around Australia, in all major capital cities, as well as in all regional and rural areas. We are employing hundreds of years of critical care nursing experience combined. We are employing hundreds of critical care nurses in general. That work in the community. There's no other service provider that brings in a higher skill level than we do into the community in Australia. We're also providing level 2 and level 3 NDA support coordination. We're also providing TAC and WorkSafe case management in Victoria with Lucy McCotter. And, you know, we can help you. We can help you whether it's with Intensive Care Hotline. We can help you whether it is with intensive care at home. Also, if you like my videos, like the video, subscribe to my YouTube channel for regular updates for families in intensive care and intensive care at home. Click the like button, click the notification bell. Share this video with anyone that will benefit from it. You know, anyone who knows, you know, who is in need of this information. Share it and I will talk to you again next week, same time, 10:30 a.m. Sydney, Melbourne time on a Sunday, which next week will be 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in the US, because we are going into daylight saving here. 7:30 p.m. Saturday, Eastern Standard Time next week, which is 4:30 p.m. Pacific Time in the US next Saturday. Take care, look after yourselves, have a good week, and keep checking into my channel here. Take care for now.